Hello, and welcome to the last in this series of More or Less, a window into the world of numbers and statistics. This week, do beautiful people have more daughters? It's a theory I find quite plausible. I have two daughters. We'll talk to Google's chief economist, and that's the opening chord of the Beatles' A Hard Day's Night. But it's also something of a magical mystery, or perhaps a mathematical mystery. We'll explain why. But first, the government's official climate advisers, the Committee on Climate Change, warned this week that it would be hard for the aviation industry to cut back on carbon dioxide emissions, and so the rest of the economy would have to reduce emissions even further by 2050, by 90% in fact. With uncanny prescience, listener Vladimir Gorolov wrote to us several weeks ago with a question about such long-term forecasts of our demand to travel around in flying tin cans. He pointed out that holiday travel is constrained by the availability of time off work, while business travel competes with fast-improving communication technology. We'll probably be richer, but it's not at all obvious we'll plough the cash into air travel. All very interesting, so I put Vladimir's points to Ben Coombs, the senior aviation analyst for the Committee on Climate Change.
We are doing our own forecast in-house at the moment, which will be part of our December report. DFT had some forecasts out in January. And I think the interesting thing is that at the global level, you see demand at a higher level than the UK because some of the sort of emerging economies in Asia, Pacific, Middle East are likely to see growth rates of more like 6%, whereas Europe and North America may be down at 3 to 4%. And actually, even in the UK, the DFT's forecast has demand annualised to 2050 at about 2%.
Is it really reasonable to assume that these numbers are just going to keep growing and growing and growing pretty much forever?
I think that's right, that they will not continue to grow at the same rate forever. And I think there is going to be a slowing in demand in the UK. I mean, we've seen rates at sort of 5 to 7% in the sort of 1990s, early 2000s. And we're talking about dropping to 2%. Will it remain at 2% or will demand growth go below that? Well, there are factors that change demand. Carbon pricing will have an impact. Video conferencing is another aspect. There is the simple fact that, you know, people will not take 10 holidays or flying holidays a year. And we are also looking at market maturity, and DFT have that built within their model as well. That has been taken somewhat into account, and we need to look at whether, you know, we think that that is a reasonable level or whether it needs to go beyond that. But I think it's important to realise that the demand growth on these global forecasts is really being driven by sort of Asia and the Middle East rather than from sort of UK and Europe. And that's why you see the different levels and such high emissions growth out to 2050.
Ben Coombs, aviation analyst at the Committee on Climate Change. Another climate change story caught our eye this week. Dr. Mojib Latif of the Leibniz Institute of Marine Sciences gave a speech at the UN's World Climate Conference predicting that the Earth might actually cool down over the next decade or so. Dr. Latif believes global warming is occurring, and he's worried about scepticism taking hold if temperatures do temporarily fall. His prediction is based on a new kind of computer model, which bridges the gap between weather forecasting over days or weeks and long-term climate forecasting over several decades. Such short-term climate forecasts require lots of computing power because they take into account not just external influences on the climate, such as carbon dioxide concentrations, but also ongoing internal climate fluctuations, for instance, El Niño. These models are a recent development, and there are a few out there, including Dr. Latif's model and one at the UK's Meteorological Office. I spoke to Mojib Latif and asked him what was so special about these new, shorter-term climate models.
Well, there are two types of climate changes. One type is what we refer to as externally driven changes. So, for instance, through volcanic eruptions or changes in solar radiation, or due to our influence, or mankind's influence on climate by the emission of certain gases into the atmosphere like carbon dioxide, and this is referred to as global warming. However, there are also internal processes, for instance, through changes in the ocean circulation, in the ocean currents, that can also produce climate changes, but more or less short-term climate fluctuations. And we try to incorporate these fluctuations into our prediction models by trying to reconstruct past variations in ocean currents and feed those into our prediction model.
So is that the difference between the way your model works and the kind of climate change models we've heard about for, well, years and years, used by the IPCC to forecast temperatures to 2050, 2100. It's this internal element.
Yes, exactly. So we are trying, in addition to the long-term trend, to include the internal processes, and these internal processes, these internal fluctuations, they ride, so to speak, on the long-term climate warming trend. We have to say that this is a completely new type of research, and as such, these forecasts have to be considered as experimental. And this is reflected by these two completely different predictions for the upcoming decade. So the Met Office colleagues basically predict that the global warming trend will basically continue as it did during the last decades, also for the next decade, and we predict that there will be basically a kind of halt in the global warming trend for the next decade or so. However, thereafter, we expect that global warming will pick up again. Now, the difference comes basically from what we call the initialization of the forecast model. So you have to give to the prediction model the observed climate state. However, we don't really have much measurements from the oceans, especially from subsurface levels. And here is basically the difference. We used only the surface information, but fed this surface information to a coupled ocean atmosphere model, while our colleagues from the Met Office used all the information, also the subsurface information, and fed this only to the ocean component of the coupled model. And then we both basically did our predictions with the coupled ocean atmosphere model.
So you had a slightly more complex model with a slightly simpler data set, if I understand what you said. I'm sure you are well aware that there are many people who are still skeptical about climate change. Wouldn't they point at these two supposedly very sophisticated models, two well-regarded climate forecasting institutes predicting something different, and they would just say, look, you know, the boffins have no idea what they're doing?
Well, this would be like comparing apples and oranges. You know, one, if we are concerned with the global warming trend, this is a completely different type of prediction, and we actually don't call this prediction, we call this projection, than the prediction we are now talking about, the short-term prediction. So one is, in mathematical terms, a boundary value problem. So the global warming problem is a boundary value problem. The short-term problem is an initial value problem. And if people compare these two and try to claim that these people don't know what to do, then they simply show that they have no idea whatsoever what climate prediction really means.
Dr. Mujib Latif of the Leibniz Institute of Marine Sciences. Closer to home, the Met Office have their own short-term climate model. I spoke to Dr. Vicky Pope, their head of climate change advice, and asked why she thinks their model is better.
These sort of predictions going 10 years ahead are fairly new. We were the first people to produce it, and it was only a few years ago. So not very many groups have done this yet. So there's still a lot of science that's developing. But what we've done is we have a model of both the atmosphere and the ocean. And the critical thing that we think is that actually including the ocean in the model is very important, because we need to capture the heat that's stored in the ocean. So we need to make sure the initial conditions in the ocean are right, because that heat will determine what happens over the next 10 years in terms of the atmospheric conditions. Now, our model does that. The German model doesn't do that. It just includes the sea surface temperature. And that was the first step that they took. They're now, I believe, improving their model to include an ocean as well. So it's likely that our model is producing more reliable results, but it's still only a probability prediction, of course. As I say, the science is very new.
If the cooling that the Leibniz Institute predict actually takes place, are you worried that that's going to take some of the wind out of the sails of scientists who are warning about the threat of global warming?
It's very important to realise that there will be 10-year periods where the temperatures don't increase, or they even decrease, as the Leibniz study is suggesting.
We've just had one.
Yes, in fact we have. But that doesn't mean that global warming has stopped. It's simply a question of natural variability, giving a temporary decrease in temperature overlaid on top of a long-term warming trend. And in fact, I believe that's what the results of that study suggest.
Sorry to interrupt, but you say that we're going to have 10-year periods of cooling. How can we be sure that the rapid warming we saw in the 1980s and 1990s wasn't the exceptional period?
This is the point, really, is that 1998 was exceptionally warm because there was an El Niño, because there was a natural variation overlaid on top of climate change. So what you can see very clearly is a long-term trend, and then these periods of rapid warming and less rapid warming or even cooling overlaid on top of that because of natural variations.
Dr. Vicky Pope, Head of Climate Change Advice at the Met Office. In a previous series, we discussed whether the planet was currently heating up and even got a pair of climate pundits to make a bet on it. You can hear that item on our website, bbc.co.uk/moreorless. Also the place for other goodies, including articles by our partners at the Open University. You're listening to More or Less, and I'm Tim Harford. Earlier in the summer, the Sunday Times reported, strikingly, that women are getting more beautiful. Their story read, "The researchers have found beautiful women have more children than their plainer counterparts, and a higher proportion of those children are female." The quoted research came from Helsinki University, but when we looked into it, we found that the most prolific academic in this field is Dr. Satoshi Kanazawa from the London School of Economics. Dr. Kanazawa has published such studies as Why Beautiful People Have More Daughters, Why Engineers Have More Sons, Why Nurses Have More Daughters, and Why Big Tall Parents Have More Sons. Well, Dr. Kanazawa's work has attracted the attention of Professor Andrew Gelman, a statistician at Columbia University in New York. The attention is not terribly favourable, I'm afraid.
When I heard about these papers, to be honest, my first reaction was scepticism, because the literature on sex ratios shows that it takes a lot to affect the sex ratio. About 51.5% of babies born are boys. It's close to that percentage just about everywhere under almost all conditions. Now, it was a clever idea that Kanazawa had to look in these data and see what he could see. People were rated as attractiveness 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And if you would do what I would consider a standard statistical analysis called a linear regression, you would look at the probability of having a girl birth as a function of attractiveness. And it turns out the estimate is not statistically significant. The estimate is that attractive people are 4.7 percentage points more likely to have girls, and it has a standard error of 4.3%, which in layman's terms means the truth in the general population could be either positive or negative. We usually don't call something statistically significant unless it's two standard errors away from zero.
So that's the result you get if you do a standard linear regression with attractiveness 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. That's not what Kanazawa did.
That's not what he did. He compared attractiveness level 5 to attractiveness level 1, 2, 3, and 4. And there he found that there was a difference of several percentage points, and that difference was statistically significant. What's wrong with that is there's an arbitrariness to the comparison. After all, you could also compare attractiveness 4 and 5 to 1, 2, and 3, or you could compare 3, 4, and 5 to 1 and 2, or 2, 3, 4, and 5 to 1. By picking just one comparison out of the many possible ones, that makes it more likely you'll find a statistically significant result just by chance. Given that we are pretty sure from the literature that any effects are going to be 1 percentage point or less, it's virtually impossible to learn anything from a study of just a few thousand people here. The larger problem is that the statistics were really against him from the start.
To be statistically significant, any effect that I find that is statistically significant on a small sample is going to be implausibly large, and so I shouldn't believe it anyway.
Exactly. I'll give you an analogy. Suppose you do a survey of 1,000 people to find out their political preferences. You'll report the result, and they'll say there's a margin of error of plus or minus 3 percentage points. Now, if you're trying to detect effects that are probably less than 1 percentage point, maybe more like a third of a percentage point or less, you're going to need a huge sample size. So a survey of 3,000 people in 5 different attractiveness categories is not going to be enough. That's only going to be enough if you're really looking for effects that are on the order of 5 or 10 percentage points. And that's something that's completely implausible.
Andrew Gelman, Professor of Statistics at Columbia University in New York. I should say we did offer Dr. Kanazawa the opportunity to respond to Professor Gelman's remarks. Last week, Simon Singh joined us to complain about the prostitution of maths and science in the service of public relations. And several listeners, precisely one-third of them identifying himself as a loyal podcaster, have drawn our attention to a rather striking example which cropped up this week. The Telegraph ran a story which claimed that half of Britons have been injured on coffee breaks by their biscuits. If that's true, it's certainly news. Who knew that biscuit-related injuries were so alarmingly common? The provenance of the story? It came from Foxes, a biscuit maker, which had commissioned research on dangerous biscuits from a company called MindLab International. What's MindLab? They say on their website they've worked with a majority of the world's foremost public relations consultancies on an extensive range of projects designed to obtain the widest and most positive media coverage for their clients. They invite you to call them if you want science behind your next set of headlines. Well, thanks to The Telegraph, MindLab certainly delivered a headline for Foxes. Is it a good use of science or of newspaper space? Simon Singh would, I fear, think not. But that's the way the cookie crumbles. In the 1967 film The Graduate, Benjamin Braddock was given careers advice in one word: plastics. 4 decades on, Google's chief economist, Halvarian, has a different word: statistics. I keep saying the sexy job in the next 10 years will be statisticians, he's been quoted as saying. People think I'm joking. Well, is he joking? I spoke to Halvarian down the line from the Googleplex at Mountain View, California, and I asked him why statistics was the career of the future.
Well, it's good to be complementary to something that's ubiquitous and cheap. And what's ubiquitous and cheap? It's data. There's data everywhere. And so being able to analyze that data, being able to make sense of that data, being able to apply it to solve problems, that's a very critical skill in today's world. I don't want to indicate that it's simply statistics narrowly defined, but there's a whole set of skills surrounding statistics and data analysis, being able to access the data, being able to organize the data, being able to visualize the data. All of those are critical skills.
Give us an example of how data analysis is going to give somebody the competitive edge.
Between every buyer and seller, virtually, there's a computer, and there's a record of that transaction. And the data that's acquired about those transactions could be immensely valuable in improving the performance of the business.
What advice would you give to someone who is maybe 16 or 17, they haven't really specialized yet, they're going to go to college in a couple of years? Based on what you've said about how important statistics are going to be, would you say, look, you've got to study economics, you've got to study maths, or would your advice be a bit more subtle than that?
Well, I think it is important to study mathematics and feel comfortable with mathematical terminology, mathematical use. It's not for everybody, of course, but everybody will need to have a basic knowledge. So my view is you should find something you're really passionate about. Maybe it's economics, maybe it's oceanography, maybe it's law, whatever. But within that field, there will be opportunity and maybe a necessity to analyze data. So acquiring the skills that enable you to do that is going to be important to your success in any field.
Do you really think things are going to change? I mean, it seems to me that in the US, the power always seems to go to the lawyers. Your president is a lawyer. In the UK, it's law or maybe Latin and Greek. You know, all those classical subjects, all to do with manipulating arguments, manipulating words, social skills. Surely things aren't really going to change. The geeks are not going to rise to the top. You're not going to have a statistician for president.
Well, let's look at our billionaires in America. How many of our billionaires are lawyers?
Okay, point taken. So, yeah, Bill Gates, I don't recall. I don't think he studied law, did he?
He was a college dropout, is what I heard.
Halvarian, chief economist at Google. And he's right. Bill Gates did drop out of Harvard. Good job, too. He had been studying law. This week, the British Medical Association called for a complete ban on alcohol advertising. The BMA may have a point, and they may not, but I'm not sure about their grasp of statistics. Here's their spokesperson on Radio 4's 6 o'clock news on Tuesday.
Young people's recognition of alcohol logos is strongly correlated not only to the fact that they're likely to start drinking well before they're 18, but the amount that they drink.
Dr. Vivienne Nathanson, head of BMA Science and Ethics, but possibly not of BMA Statistics. Let me translate. She just said that the people who start drinking young and drink a lot are the people who tend to know more about alcohol brands. This also suggests that people who don't drink at all know very little about alcohol brands. None of this is terribly surprising. Repeat after me. Correlation is not causation. And now for something completely different. That, of course, is the opening chord of A Hard Day's Night, one of the Beatles' most instantly recognisable sounds, but it's also one of their most mysterious. Loyal reporter Ruth Alexander is here to tell us why. Ruth, are you proposing to take us on a mathematical mystery tour?
I am. Over the years, lots of guitarists have tried and failed to recreate that chord. Until now, no one really knew exactly how it was made.
Apart from Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr, I suppose.
OK, apart from them. But now, someone else knows too. Jason Brown, a professor from Dalhousie University in Canada, he's figured it out using maths. He's applied what's called a Fourier transform, which can basically take a chord and break it down into its component frequencies and their amplitudes.
So we're getting into the physics of sound here.
We are, yes. When you play a musical note, you're producing not one single sound, but a mesh of sounds. You tend to hear only the main fundamental tone, which is the loudest, but in the background there are also some other higher frequency tones, harmonic overtones. And different instruments produce different overtones, which is why they have different characteristic sounds, and that's where Professor Brown started his investigation.
When I took the digitized sound and ran it through this process, one of the things that I came up with, first of all, was that a note that everyone seems to have heard, a low G, was not present in the chord. It was simply something that people were hearing in the chord, inferring in the chord, that wasn't present. But I did more than that. I started to assign the notes to George Harrison's brand new 12-string Rickenbacker guitar, Paul McCartney's bass and John Lennon's 6-string, and I ran into a roadblock. The chord wasn't playable. There were three frequencies of a certain F note that simply couldn't be assigned to anyone, and this puzzled me for a long time until I had an epiphany where I realized perhaps the chord was not being played just by the Beatles. And I realized that a piano typically has three strings under each note, and that what might account for these extra notes was a piano being added to the mix. So I immediately jumped in my car and ran down to a local music store. It must have been quite a sight as I began to stick my head inside all the grand pianos. And what I came up with was that indeed the notes that I needed to assign to the piano were playable on the piano.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping.
So that's it, you'd used math to solve the riddle of that famous chord.
Right, and the mathematics gave evidence, it gave proof that the piano was in the mix and precisely what notes were being played.
Everything seems to be right when I'm home, feeling you holding me tight, tight, yeah. It's been a hard...
Is everyone convinced?
Probably not. You know, I've had some emails from people who will tell me that, first of all, I shouldn't have looked at the mystery. It should remain a mystery. People will write to me saying, you know, they don't believe in mathematics. They'll go by what they hear.
Mathematics just hocus pocus, isn't it, really?
Hey, Jude.
Now, what makes a rock and roll voice sound rock and roll?
Take a sad song and make it better.
I took the opening note of Hey Jude that Paul McCartney sings, which is a nice pure tone, a pure C, and I contrasted that with the opening shriek,
Mr. Moonlight,
that John Lennon does on Mr. Moonlight, which is a great rock and roll sound. I've taken those opening notes and I've run it through a Fourier transform. And when I looked at Hey Jude, the opening C,
hey,
you see that Paul McCartney's voice very clearly emphasizes that fundamental note. That's at about 261 hertz. It's a C. And the other harmonics are of much smaller amplitude, which means much less loud. On the other hand, I was surprised when I looked at that opening shriek that John does on Mr. Moonlight. He's singing an A,
Mister!
But that A is not the loudest tone in that sound that he produces. What are louder are the second, third, and fourth harmonics. And in particular, that third harmonic is the loudest. So it's quite interesting, and I've looked at a number of their shrieks in rock and roll. Yes, baby. Woo, baby. And I find that, again, the higher harmonics are what are being emphasized. Well, long tall Sally, she's Bibb's piece of guy. Everything that Uncle John need, oh baby. Yes, baby. Woo, baby. And rock and roll singers do this naturally. Yeah. Well, I saw Uncle John with bald head Sally. He saw Mary coming and he ducked back in the alley, oh baby. So again, mathematics comes to the rescue and allows us to see things that are hidden from us just by using our ears. Mathematics is often seen as austere, as unemotional, but mathematics can be extremely emotional in the context of music. One of the things that I've investigated was the natural inclination for people to like groupings of one pattern against groupings of another pattern. Chuck Berry did this often. He'd duck walk at precisely the point where he'd have groupings of threes against the background of groupings of four. And it's subconscious, but that's what I find with the best songwriters and the best musicians, that they often have this mathematical inclination hardwired. And everyone, whether you're mathematically inclined or not, finds these attractive, finds these moving, finds these exciting.
Ruth Alexander, speaking to Beatlemaniac mathematician Jason Brown. Sadly for us, and perhaps you will shed a tear as well, that's all we've got time for this series. What have we achieved with our 165 minutes of airtime? Well, we've learned that claims about the Islamification of Europe are wildly exaggerated, that the assertions that 75% of UK law comes from Brussels and that 9% of UK law comes from Brussels are about equally true, that if you think you've had swine flu, you probably haven't, that the conviction rate for rape isn't as low as it looks, and that the finding that 7 million Britons use illegal file-sharing websites comes from research funded by the record industry. Most importantly, we use statistics to advise the England cricket team how to win the Ashes, and the England cricket team won the Ashes. Correlation doesn't imply causation, of course, but I think you'll agree it is a pretty striking coincidence. If you want to hear any of those stories again, why not check out our secret programme archive on our website, bbc.co.uk/moreorless. It goes all the way back to 2003, and it's so secret, I only found out it existed yesterday. We've tried to make it easier to find, so enjoy. I hope it will keep even the most loyal of listeners happy until we return with a new series in December. Until then, goodbye.